Welcome back to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB 1310. That's where the streets have new name, but we have an important street here in the Portland area, Preble Street. Please join me in welcoming Mark Swan as the executive director of the Preble Street, and he's also involved with lots of community programs that are so important to not just Portland, but me in general. Welcome to the show again, Mark.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You've been on here before, and typically we have folks give their background, but I think that we could do 2 hours on your background and your giving and all that. So I really want to focus, especially this time of year, we're heading into a cold season, we're heading into holiday season, and I really want to talk about the what's going on here in Preble Street. But if you can start with, for listeners that may not be familiar with what Preble Street is, mm-hmm. and then we'll talk in a larger scope in terms of the work that's being done and where people can be involved and kind of what's going on with public policy in a broader range here in the state. Mm-hmm. But for people that aren't familiar, why don't we start with talking about a little bit of the structure and the scope and the good work being done at Preble Street?
Sure. Great. Happy to do that. I think if people know about Preble Street, they usually think about or know about our soup kitchen or the shelters we run, kind of the basic needs, emergency services. And that is a big part of what we do, and we're really proud of that. We have 3 soup kitchens and a couple emergency shelters, one for women, one for children. We have drop-in centers for runaway and homeless teens and another drop-in center for adults and a health clinic and a lot of basic emergency needs. And again, we're proud of that work, but we think of our work in a couple different paths, really. One is the emergency services, but the other is more the solution-oriented work that we're involved in and we want to do more of. And that really started about 10 years ago when we developed Logan Place, which was the first housing-first project in New England, where we really kind of turned things upside down in the housing models and provided housing for people who are chronically homeless. And I could do 2 hours just on the housing first work we do, and that was really important. And we built off that to develop Florence House, which is a housing first model for women. We also have started in the last 5 years a statewide veterans housing service program, which we actually have offices in Bangor and Lewiston, where we've been serving, over 750 vets just in the last year that we've moved out of shelters. So again, the emergency services are important, but we really want to try to, move the needle a little bit with preventative and solution-oriented work.
Talk a little bit about you've worked in the area of social services for decades. Why housing itself? Because it feels like there are a number of factors that go into people of need, whether it's employment. Oftentimes there's attendant addiction issues and alcohol issues. But from our earlier conversations and from reading much of what you've written, housing feels like it's a key cog that impacts all those other things, because at the end of the day, it is a critical human need for housing and protection. And it also is a key element in terms of human dignity that can help mm-hmm. break the cycle of the other factors that really lead to, people here in Maine and all over the country in need. But why, in your research, is the housing part of it so critical to just look at that individually?
Yeah. Well, it's probably worth saying right up front, and I often forget to do this, but, 80% of the people who come through our doors move out of our doors within a few weeks. I mean, most people who are experiencing homelessness, it's a situation in their life they didn't expect. It's economics, it's health, it's a landlord issue, it's a family issue. And the emergency nature of our work kicks in. And within 2 or 3 weeks, they are settled again. And it often is a housing issue. The 15 or 20% of people who get really, really stuck on the street and in shelters, that's the population most people notice. It sort of fits the stereotypes. They cost a lot of money. They're really challenging. It's a lot of heartbreak for families and communities. And that's where we've identified, as you're describing, housing is the key piece. It's not the only piece. And in fact, the housing first, what comes second is the other issues, trying to deal with the other issues, addictions, employment, mental health issues, medical issues. It's if you deal with the theory is, and we've kind of proven out that it works, if you can address the housing situation first, then you can people, as you said, get settled, have a home, know where they're spending that particular night. I mean, if you are on the street, and particularly if you're suffering from mental illness or addiction issues, you don't know where you're going to spend that night. You know, your day to day is very much about survival and getting through that day.
And so, thinking about employment and all the other things, and then family relationships, right. And the your support structure kind of disintegrates when you're on the street many times too.
Absolutely.
Because you don't have a kind of a base where people can kind of help you go to where you're living and that type of thing.
Yeah. One of the things, you know, we're a bunch of social workers, and when we developed Logan Place, you know, it was very much a unknown kind of model back then. And we put a whole bunch of kind of goals for the clients, for the community, for the agency, and it was all related to people's employment, people's their mental health services, their quality of life, whether they were connected to an addiction program, whether they went to AA meetings. It was all those kind of goals you can imagine. What we never put down there, and it's kind of a shame on us, is family reunifications. And to your point, We saw and continue to see people who had been on the street for years and were entirely estranged from their family reconnecting with a son that they hadn't seen in 15 years, a brother that they hadn't seen in 10 years, reconnecting with them, enjoying the holidays with them, getting to know their nieces and nephews, just really heartbreaking stuff. Wonderful. I mean, not heartbreaking, heart-building stuff, right. Just wonderful.
You wrote something a few years ago that I wasn't really aware of, but people have talked about, we're in the year 2015, almost 2016, and it feels like the situation with people of need and homelessness has accelerated or has grown over time. And I think that was part of what you pointed out years ago, is the family dynamic has changed.
Right.
The support services have changed. People's whether it's through church programs where church attendance and church connectivity has been reduced over the last couple of decades, well noted in terms of family dynamics, in terms of split families, those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
But all that has played a really big role, hasn't it, in terms of where we are today with people in areas of hopelessness sometimes?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, and there was a gentleman that was well-known in our community. He had been actually injured in World War II and had a head injury, and he essentially kind of wandered around town, but everybody kept an eye on him. And, if he went a little too far with his behaviors or ended up somewhere he shouldn't be, people would call his brother who owned the gas station, and his brother would come get him, and we all kind of looked out for him. I think that has changed dramatically in our communities now.
And you referenced a book by Robert Putman, Bowling Alone.
Right.
It's kind of describing some of the, because, we hear about relative to kids, and I don't recall exactly where the phenomenon was first introduced, but it takes a village. Mm-hmm. And so I definitely want to talk about teen homelessness, teen need, but all of us, I know from my personal experience growing up, and I know from, just empirical experience, that it takes, nobody ever does it alone, literally or figuratively, whether it's in business or whether it's in life in general. Mm-hmm. And it feels like for the people in the greatest need, their connectedness to other people or support systems or their village, when those connections get lost, and then that leads to obviously some profound personal need, but there's also a social element that seems as though it's been politicized in recent years, whereas, particularly here in Maine, particularly from our state government, there's a bit of a conflict between, I think, policy in Portland area. I personally don't think that abuse in the system is a huge issue. I don't think if anyone had their choice,
right,
they would choose to sleep on a 6-inch mat on the floor of a community center. they would prefer to have a job, prefer to have engagement in society.
Right.
But where does that come from, and you know, what's the current environment for that right now?
Oh, it's the worst part of my job by far is the politics and the mythologies and the stereotypes and you know the premise that particularly in with the population we're working with, the premise that people are getting away with something by coming to our soup kitchen or sleeping on the floor of these incredibly crowded, loud, chaotic, intimidating, scary shelters is just, it's ridiculous to think that people are trying to somehow get away with something when really they're just in dire need. And we have a responsibility to serve them. I mean, over the last 20 years, about every 2 or 3 years, I go to a national conference on homelessness in the summer in Washington. And so you get to know people from around the country and you have dinner with them and whatnot. And for years, people would talk about their state or their city suffering from what they called compassion fatigue, which is just what it sounds like, just people, you know, having enough is enough and not wanting to help poor people or disabled people or people who are different. And I used to always say, well, you know, that's not the case in Maine. It's a pretty caring community. It's a pretty great state to be doing this kind of work. And I can't say that anymore. And that has changed dramatically in the last few years where it feels like poor people are being blamed for being poor. It feels like the value of a human being is directly related to how much money they have and not the kind of person they are. It's really frustrating to do our work.
What do you think is the underlying catalyst for that? Is it that people of need have less voice or fewer platforms to kind of express? You know, there's yourself and there's people who are working in the organizations. But right. The bigger issue is last night, 100, 200 people slept in shelters in Portland. I don't know what the exact number
is.
So 400 people last night.
Right.
And today, there will be hundreds of people lined up just to get food, not because it's they're gaming the system, but because without that food, it also turns into a health crisis. It also turns into a public safety crisis. There's so many things connected to this issue.
Right. I think that's where I said the politics are the hardest part of my job, because that's pure politics. That's what that is. Being grown-ups and trying to really solve really complex problems. That's just bumper sticker stuff. It appeals to political bases, and it's intellectually lazy. I mean, if people spent time, did some work, really looked at what we're dealing with every day, the conclusions they would come up with quite quickly, I believe, are that, wow, there's a lot of people with untreated mental illness in this community. There are a lot of people suffering from addictions in this community. There are a lot of people with significant medical issues. I mean, every single night there's a dozen or so people in wheelchairs in our shelters. I mean, those are the issues, as you should suggest, Steve-O. Those are what we should be talking about. But instead, demonizing, blaming, shaming, it becomes, you know, those are the headlines. Those are what people run for office on. And it's not just, I mean, it's politics, but it's also somehow it's become okay in our overall, our bigger culture, TV shows, movies, you know, don't get me started on that, but how often do you watch a TV show and they make fun of somebody who's homeless? Or they make a joke about beating up somebody who's on the street.
Plot line where somebody is panhandling. And before we get into that, I also want to introduce Valerie Hamilton, who's here with us. Morning, Val.
Good morning.
Val works with us here at TideSmart. She heads up ProAmerica Health. And Val came to me a few weeks ago with a group of people here at TideSmart and said, hey, we have a community service component to our group. And she said, I want to organize something where we have a group of people go down to Preble Street. And so, Val, why don't you talk a little bit from your experience? And I know that long before you organized that here, you personally were involved with Preble Street. So talk about your experience, and you've brought your kids down there, and then this week the experience you had bringing a group of people, helping out, seeing firsthand, and really being kind of part of the solution.
I'm one of the biggest fans of Preble Street. I think that you will find it's been just a tremendous place for me to take my children. And it's probably the best family time that we ever experience. And when myself and my three children go there, we always get, you know, big jobs to do. Feeding that many people at one time, it's a challenge that my children had never faced before, working hard. And it gives us perspective for ourselves as a family, seeing what other folks have to go through. And I think it's really helped with my children to build compassion and empathy and to be part of the solution rather than just living and not being aware of the challenges that are right down the road from us. So I can't say enough nice things about what it's done for us as a family. So we were just amazed with everything that all the good work that is being done there. And employees, it was just one of the best days ever, and had so much fun.
So Val, for listeners and for people that may have work at other companies, talk about the process of contacting Preble Street. So if anyone listening has an interest in volunteering, there's always need down there. Obviously, there's need for donations and supporting what they're doing, and you can go to preblestreet.org. But for a company that wants to be attached in terms of really helping out, what's your suggestion from your experience and on how we went about it and then how you organized having people go down and what the feedback was from, you know, the 20 or so people who went down and helped out this week?
Well, I have to say I'm from the Midwest, and whenever you would try to volunteer in a certain organization, there were always all these hurdles and barriers, and it was very hard to organize anything. But I went right to the volunteer link on the Preble Street website, and I was connected with Tori, who right away said how many employees, what would they like to do. She split us up into three groups to make sure that we didn't just go and stand around, but she really made sure that every person who showed up had a designated job to do, and that at the end of the day they felt like they had made a difference. Everybody worked hard that day, and it was the best, very best kind of work. So Preble Street absolutely makes it simple, and connecting with Tori, just clicking on that volunteer link, and they just take it from there. And they're so appreciative. Once we were there, everybody walked away feeling very appreciated for what they had done that day. But it's just indescribable, the feeling.
Yeah, there's something about helping out that I think, you know, many times people think it's a one-way, I don't want to call it a transaction, not in the literal sense, but it's a one-way process. But I think that when either a company does something good and engages in the community or individuals, I think there's benefit on both sides of the equation. And I think from our experience this week, and with that, the employees have decided, and this was really driven by Val and, you know, her group being active on this, that they wanted to provide a donation from the company associated with their involvement. And I have a check for $1,000 from Tide Smart and our associates and all of our employees here that we want to immediately
you.
Because giving time is certainly important. Giving labor is important because the organization really needs people, you know, kind of boots on the ground. But funding is a big issue also. So
with
our appreciation for allowing us to be part of Preble Street, we also want to provide that. In the next few minutes we have Mark Swan here. He's the executive director of Preble Street. I think there's need across the spectrum, but I'm particularly sensitive to the issue we have with kids in Maine and teens in Maine, and whether it's in summer food programs that have gone away because of schools have stopped providing and some communities food service. What's the situation, particularly on the youngest members of our community, being teens and preteens, relative to social service needs? And what are you seeing in Portland that are of particular concern or focus that people should be aware of?
Well, we do have a teen shelter for youth age 12 to 21 and a teen center for the same ages. Those two programs really are open together 24 hours where kids can be safe. And this is for runaway and homeless kids who are on their own. And sadly, it's very busy. The shelter itself is full most nights. At the teen center, we have meals there. We have a drop-in center. But really importantly, we have a lot of services there for kids. We really try to embrace these kids immediately before they get too deep into the street culture and bad habits and meeting people and the exploitation that can happen. We have clinicians there working from day one, which is a wonderful nonprofit that we partner with. We have a public health clinic there for kids. And very importantly, we have a full-time school program run by the city of Portland. So we have been able to manage to pull together kind of a comprehensive approach to serve kids. But it's really a sad, sad situation where you've got dozens of kids every single day on their own on the street. We work really closely with the state. I will give the state credit that they've really stepped up a lot in the last few years to pay more attention to these kids. Half of the kids we see are in state custody one way or another, or state care. So we got to reconnect them with the state, and the state has stepped up in some very positive ways. So we're doing our best. But I also just, first, I want to thank you for the gift. That's really a great surprise and very generous of your company. And Valerie, thank you for your great comments. That's really wonderful. You know, it is about kindness and compassion, and you're teaching your kids, and this company is kind of living and breathing that. That's really wonderful. You know, we have to, every year we're serving or distributing about 600,000 meals. I mean, it's an enormous logistical undertaking, but we use about 6,000 volunteers to do it. I mean, so the logistics of, as you say, clicking on a button and trying to connect with us, it's so heartening to hear that it's working, because we really do need the volunteers from the community and companies and churches to step up. So really, thank you very much.
No, thank you for the opportunity and the good work you do. And obviously, you have an organization with staff that are really doing things day in and day out. And that is so, for me, inspiring to see both your work, and I've known you for a few years and have great respect for your work personally, but for the dozens of people that day in and day out, that they've made this their life work. They've made this, you know, in any area of social service. That is one of, I think, the most noble pursuits, you know, whether it's teaching or whether it's in any area that's going on. And for the people, you mentioned the teen center, for the people that help out and staff the center and they're there 24 hours, it says a lot about them, their character, yours, and the people that are helping out, because it's not easy work, because you're dealing with a lot of, I don't want to say darkness, because you're providing good services, but it is not a comfortable environment. It is something that is important work, but it also comes with a weight, because you're seeing such struggle in the area of humanity that it has to have an impact for the people working there day in, day out, too.
It really does, Steve-O. The staff, the social workers, the people who work in the kitchen, I mean, they're incredible heroes in the community, because they're doing very important work. It's you know, daily challenges. And as you said, there's a lot of sadness and tragedies to it. We had two memorial services this week for people in our community who've died. I never would have known or thought going into this work the amount of grieving that happens at our center, in our community, with the staff. But we also, you know, truthfully, I think people who do the work feel pretty honored to be doing the work, to be kind of walking that path with people who are very honest. There's a lot of honesty in our buildings and our programs, not much pretension at all. People just building relationships and sharing their stories in ways that are, you know, just extraordinary sometimes. So I think the people who work there struggle and are challenged with it, but also, you know, deeply love it too.
Great. We have Mark Swan here, the executive director of Preble Street. In the last couple of minutes, talk a little bit about both, you know, you mentioned politics, which is kind of the narrative that I think we both share a disdain for relative to putting so much blame on people in need. But at the same time, when it comes to funding and changes of policy, politics and government is also a critical part of it, whether it's on the city level where Preble Street is based, or whether it's in the state level in Augusta. What areas would you like to see our government be more sensitive and be more effective in terms of recognizing the issues as opposed to demonizing? And what portion relative to Preble Street lives within city government in terms of what can be done, and what part of it is really driven by state policy in Augusta?
Gee, that's a lot to ask in with a minute left.
No, we've got a few minutes.
Okay. Well, the funding piece is a part of it for sure. But at Preble Street, we've tried to avoid the trap that I think a lot of nonprofits get in, which is they get too connected to one or two funding sources, public funding sources in particular, and they end up following the funding rather than their mission. And we've worked really hard to avoid that. And one way we've done that is by really trying to focus on the private fundraising side, so we're not beholden to one or two funding sources. So about half of our budget is private, and support like you gave me today, the check from TideSmart and churches and individuals and corporations and foundations. Having said that, we do get public funding as well. We get very, very, very little from the city of Portland. I think people assume we get a lot of funding from the city, but it's absolutely not true. We do get some state money, and then we get some federal money as well. So the funding is a piece of it, but for the agency, but most of our advocacy or our concerns in politics isn't really about our funding. It's about the system working or not working. And I think one of the most important issues in this state is general assistance and how that is administered, how it's funded, how it works, how it doesn't work. I mean, it became a big time political football, you know, this past session, and I think it will coming up as well. But nobody's really talking about, well, does it even work? Is it work well? Is it work right, equitably across rural states and urban parts of the state? The fact is it doesn't work very well. It is really the safety net of all safety nets in this state, and it's much more important than an individual soup kitchen or a shelter. It is really the last resort for a lot of poor people, and it needs to be looked at, and it frankly needs to be completely, you know, rethought how we do that work.
Well, we've run out of time, but again, thank you for your work, and Val, thank you for joining us here today. I know you had a good experience helping out at Preble Street, and you continue to do it on your own time, right?
Absolutely. I'm one of their biggest fans.
Thank you, Valerie.
Well, thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Steve.
And we will continue to help in any way we can. And for anyone interested in information on how to help, volunteer, or if you work at a company or own a company that's thinking of doing some community service that can really help people, please go to preblestreet.org, contact them. It's not only, I think, a really positive thing to do relative to helping other people, but for an organization, it infuses a sense of spirit and giving, which is really positive on this side of the equation. So we had a great time participating.
Great.
You're listening to TideSmart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned for more of TideSmart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB.
Man, do I love card night. You ready, boys? You got a king?
Go, Fish Dad!
Oh, come on! This is WWE superstar Titus O'Neil. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to TideSmart Talk with Steve-O. It's News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. I don't know if we built the city on rock and roll, but we have a very special city in Portland, very special place in Maine. And with us now is Dana Topman, who is the president and CEO of Avesta Housing, former deputy director of the Maine State Housing Authority. Welcome, Dana.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. And earlier in the show, we had Mark Swan talking about Preble Street, doing some really good work in the community, and I think likewise, Avesta Housing does some really important work in the community. But before we start talking about that, if you wouldn't mind spending a couple of minutes talking about your background and how you came to be here in Maine and And now is the president and CEO of Avesta Housing. Then we'll talk about what Avesta Housing is, and then we'll talk about impact in the community and policy.
Sure. Well, I grew up here in Maine. I grew up on a dairy farm in Topsom, Maine, and went to Brunswick High School and University of Maine, and thought I would graduate from University of Maine and become a town manager. And somehow took a turn from that plan and ended up entering the social services field.
When you say somehow, it was an interest from an early age, and you've had an interesting academic background in terms of public policy and Duke's government leadership program, and you participated in the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. So it looks like academically you were moving into the area of public policy or politics. And what was the motivation or the interest for at your early age to get into that?
It was an interest I had my whole life. My parents, while being dairy farmers, seemed to be involved in every community and civic activity, and didn't know much about what I was going to do. And so my parents had said, the future of farming doesn't look very good, and I didn't like it anyway. So I developed this interest in town government, and that sort of morphed into a broader public policy interest that has led me into the field I'm in.
I share that interest that you had, and I still share it. I think that when people talk about government, and oftentimes they're denigrating government as kind of this amorphous thing, I think they lump everything together with their frustration. But here in Maine, we have 488 municipalities, towns, cities, and virtually all of them, there's some form of local government. And for the most part, it's volunteers on city councils, town councils, selectmen, and school boards and planning boards. And it's a fascinating machine at the local level, as it is in county and state and federal government. But when I think about government, and I was on the Yarmouth Planning Board, and I was chair of the Yarmouth Town Council for 3 years, it's where you're sitting in a log cabin at midnight talking about what other people would consider the smallest part of day-to-day life, or a parking ordinance change or lighting. But it's critical. It's the fabric of day-to-day life for many people, right?
It certainly is. I did my municipal internship in Yarmouth, as a matter of fact. And at that point, we were studying shellfish ordinances, which affected a lot of people's lives then, as well as trying to figure out where people's trash was going to go and what they needed for a new dump and new equipment. And so it's really municipal government touches everybody's lives. And clearly school is the biggest part of that, but it just touches people's lives. And I really have an interest. I think everybody that does this work, whether it's serving on a planning board or a council, they're trying to do good things for their town.
Right. I mean, the natural inclination to join those organizations, the municipal level, is not because you want to, you know, destruct, or you want to build, you want to make improvements, you know, for you and your neighbors, because here in Maine particularly, everyone's almost a neighbor to somebody else. So literally and figuratively, you know, it's one big village.
It certainly is. And we're all trying to create nice communities in a nice state.
So from 94 to 2000, you were the deputy director of Maine State Housing Authority. Is that approximately?
Yes.
What exactly, for people that may not be familiar, what is the Maine State Housing Authority? And then we'll talk in 2000, you became president CEO of Avesta Housing. But let's start with Maine State Housing. What is the role and the function of that?
The Maine State Housing Authority is the state's housing finance agency. And they receive funds. At times they're kind of like a bank, and at times they're a bit like a social service agency. But they help people buy their first home. They help create affordable apartments. They help address homeless challenges. They try to create special needs housing. They provide fuel assistance and weatherization assistance to low-income Maine residents. So they run an array of programs there in Augusta, and it's a long, well-established, very healthy organization.
So relative to housing authority, how much of that authority or infrastructure is at the state level, and how much autonomy do local municipalities have relative to their own approach and their own support of various housing initiatives?
Locally, the municipality's zoning is really what dictates sort of the structure that housing is going to be developed in that town. So you know, if lots sizes are smaller, then you can probably build housing less expensively than if you require 2-acre or 5-acre lots. So it's really at the municipal level, it's much more of a market-driven process where the town's zoning affects things a bit. Oftentimes, towns can contribute to affordable housing through tax increment financing districts and some other creative approaches. But the real money that is needed to make expensive housing or make housing in general more affordable comes in this state primarily all through the Maine State Housing Authority. So some of it comes directly into communities or to nonprofits from HUD and at the federal level and rural development. But Maine State Housing Authority is kind of that large intermediary in Maine.
When you say large and you must interface sometimes with them now in your current role, but what are the rough economics in terms of the state housing authority or the scope in terms of units or dollar scope that impact the state budget and what listeners and taxpayers would want, just for some context?
Sure. Maine's state housing authority has assets of well over $1 billion. I think it's about $1.5 billion. They provide mortgages each year to 400 or 500 home buyers, and so that's several hundred million dollars. So they're a large financial institution, both on an asset basis as well as on their annual revenues and expenses.
Are they guaranteeing housing purchases, or are they actually funding, or is there some combination of both?
On the single-family side, they sell bonds at a certain rate, and then they take the proceeds of those bonds and they lend them out to first-time home buyers, marked up slightly, but they are able to create a mortgage rate that is generally less than what banks and other mortgage companies can provide, and they also require a lower down payment. And then they have some special funds that they're able to use to help single-family homes become even more affordable.
Got it. And in 2000, I show in my notes that you joined Avesta Housing. Is that as the president and CEO? Or
yes. In 2000, I came to our organization, Avesta Housing. We had a different name then. It was called York Cumberland Housing. And so I left Augusta and came to York Cumberland Housing, which was headquartered in Gorham. And in 2003, we relocated our offices from Gorham to downtown Portland, and at the same time changed our name to Avesta Housing.
To broaden the scope and the your area of influence where you could work with people?
Yes, we'd already outgrown the York Cumberland County footprint. Called ourselves Avesta Housing. Vesta is the Roman goddess for home and hearth, and so that was kind of a fit that led to our name.
Fantastic. Let's spend a couple minutes talking about what Avesta Housing is, and if you wouldn't mind describing the organization, the number of people, the scope of work, and where it has evolved since when you joined in 2000 to present, you know, because I think many people are familiar with Avesta Housing kind of anecdotally, and it's mentioned in the news. Is it a state agency? Is the funding guaranteed? Is it independent? Is it set up as a nonprofit where you're not profiting from the good work you're doing? And then we'll talk about what's going on here in the state.
Yeah. We're a private nonprofit organization. We were created in 1972. Our mission is to improve lives and strengthen communities by promoting and providing quality, affordable homes to people in need. So we've been doing that since 1972. We currently have about 120 employees. We do a lot of multifamily development. We do a lot of property management of our developments. We also have an affordable assisted living program. We have a home ownership center where we assist home buyers by counseling them to get them ready to buy homes. And we do a fair amount of advocacy and public policy work around the state. So that's generally what we do. We currently have assets of about $230 million. We have about 2,200 apartments that we own or manage. We have an operating budget of about $26 million. And when I came there in 2000, we had 40 employees. We had about 700 apartments. We didn't have a home ownership center. We weren't doing advocacy. So we've sort of grown both in size and scope as well as geographically.
Fascinating. We have Dana Dotman here. He's the president and CEO of Vesta Housing. When you talk about being a private nonprofit, is there any linkage to either the Maine State Housing Authority or with the state relative to either funding or oversight, or is there any legislative control, or is it totally, is Avesta totally autonomous and operates within your own scope and your own mission?
We're independent and operate under our own scope and make our own decisions on what we're going to do. However, we receive monies from Maine State Housing Authority. We receive monies from HUD. We receive monies from rural development. We receive tax credits from private investors. We receive loans from traditional banks, all of which we combine as resources to develop and construct new housing. Once that new housing is built, many of those funders, including Maine State Housing Authority, make sure we're doing what we promised them to do, which is to serve certain people at a certain income level and to provide the housing that's safe and decent and of a quality that they expect. So we are heavily regulated by the various folks that have invested in us.
As I mentioned to you during the break, we had Mark Swan from Preble Street in earlier. And, you know, people are familiar with Preble Street and soup kitchen and food, but also a big part of what they're doing with Logan's Place is housing. And it's a basic human need. It is more of a factor in a cold weather environment where it's not just about shelter and comfort. It's literally survival. So housing is a core element. You know, there's been a lot of referendums, both, or not a lot in Portland, but there's been discussions both on the state level and the local level of mandating housing requirements or low or entry-level housing and for developers. Is that something that you're actively involved with supporting? Is that something that is ultimately kind of feeds into the Avesta mission, or is it something that is more grassroots in the community?
We're very much involved in those discussions. This past Tuesday, the election day, we had a senior affordable housing bond question that was on the ballot. It passed with 69%. It will provide $15 million to Maine State Housing Authority to provide more affordable housing for seniors. And we were very involved in the creation of that. It passed by 69%, which I think it was among the highest percentages that ever
Referendum passed, right?
Yeah. So it's clear now that there's strong sentiment that we do something. We also were involved in the issues in Portland. We were supportive of the inclusionary zone ordinance that was adopted by the city council a couple of weeks ago. And we're also involved in question two in the city of Portland, which was a proposal to create a view commission that might inhibit sort of the subsequent development of developments in Portland. And from our perspective, that would inhibit affordable housing developments. So we were involved in that as well. And we're pleased with the outcomes on all three of those policy questions.
How does that compare, you know, relative to the housing aspect of public need and public service? It feels like from what you mentioned and the results of those referendums, there is a public either interest or appetite for approving that, whereas on other social service programs, there is a lot of pushback in terms of what we're doing. But how is it that when it comes to housing or senior housing, 69% of the voters responded very positively, whereas food and medical services are just as vital for life and sustenance of life. It doesn't feel like those numbers are anywhere near as high when referendum items and policy items are connected to those other aspects of life.
I think the challenge is really starting to touch everybody. And so I think everybody knows they either have a mother or a relative or a neighbor who's struggling with wherever they're living. So it doesn't matter if you're a senior on a wait list trying to get into an affordable senior development, or if you're a frail elderly person that can't keep up with the uptake on your home. I think increasingly the entire population is being knows somebody that has a housing challenge. And then when you get into other age groups, the number of people that are homeless, the number of people that are doubling up because they can't afford an apartment, the housing crisis, if you will, is really just reaching a magnitude that people at all levels of government and the general population are realizing that we have a major challenge here that is affecting a lot of people. And it's really, unfortunately, I think, going to get worse before it gets better as housing prices increase.
Yeah, Deb, before we went on, you had a point of view relative to public programs and housing relative to how we're going to pay. Do you want to share your view on that?
And that's the concern. We are an old state. We're all aging. Obviously, we only are a few years away from retiring, most of us. We all know that sooner or later we're going to need somewhere to go, many of us, at least those who haven't got a lot of retirement that they've planned for. But the question is, how are we all going to pay for it? If all of us are aging and we're leaving the workforce and we're not having enough people brought in to replenish that, sure, where does that money come from?
I think to fund the programs that are going to provide the help, it's going to take federal government, state government, local governments all working together. That, you know, the local governments might be able to provide TIFs, they might be able to provide some density bonuses. There's some things they can do to reduce the cost of housing. I think at the state level, it's going to be a shifting of priorities and some funding, such as what happened with this $15 million senior housing bond proposal. We're going to need more of that. But then at the federal level, I think we've really got to kind of get serious about what are we going to do about housing. Currently, the federal government's major investment in housing is really the mortgage interest deduction, which helps everybody. But it particularly helps the wealthy because they get assistance by reducing their taxes for their mortgage and taxes they pay. If you're a lower income person, you don't get to realize that same benefit. So I think we're going to need to shift tax policy at some point, and it will probably mean modifying that mortgage interest deduction, which is dwarfs the size of any other housing assistance. And if we simply took the mortgage interest for homes that are over $500,000 and took it off second homes, just a very tiny slice of the mortgage interest deduction, and shifted that into subsidies to create new housing and new affordable housing, we could really solve the affordable housing challenge. But it's going to take some major review and difficult debate to look at our federal tax structure, particularly the mortgage interest deduction, which unfortunately is helping wealthy people at a much higher benefit than the low-income people.
We have Dana Topman here. He's president and CEO of Avesta. In the next few minutes that we have, talk a little bit about what I think are the most vulnerable members of our community and society, being seniors. And everyone's familiar with the statistics that Maine is the oldest state. We're a rural state in general. 35,812 square miles, 488 municipalities. We have a population that's spread out, very little density, which goes against the wind of the new economy, which needs density and efficiency. We have so many people, both in the Portland region, southern Maine region, but across the state, that, and particularly with the economy or the economic strife of the last 8 years, they've used up many times their savings, the safety net investments have been depleted to pay for operating expenses. And it feels statistically there's a huge wave of baby boomer generation retirees that are heading to retirement. They're here in Maine. They're multi-generational Mainers. And they do not have and will not have the financial resources for basic needs. And how does that fit into either your planning or policy discussions at Avesta Housing to make sure that neighbors, friends, and relatives have a place to live with a reasonable and modest level of security and human dignity?
That's our biggest challenge right now, is responding to the demands from seniors, from the baby boomers that are retiring. In large part, they want to scale down. They want to move closer to where other people are. Last year, we had 3,000 people come to us looking for housing. We were able to help about 300. So we're only able to help 1 in 10. So all of our advocacy efforts, frankly, have just got to be to keep creating more affordable alternatives for seniors, because they want to live downtown. They want to, in many cases, not be isolated, particularly when one of the couple die. Oftentimes, right. You know, they want to move, particularly when death occurs. That's when people come to us and get on their wait list. So what we really need to do is to just keep pounding away, creating as many more affordable housing units, homes as we can, and to keep advocating and pushing for our cause to have public policy respond in a bigger way to this. It's a huge problem. In addition to just creating new housing that helps, every time we do this, we put thousands of people to work constructing the housing.
Right.
And so the economic impact of building housing, just like it is when you build bridges or build highways or build
infrastructure. Sure.
Housing, we got to look at as part of that infrastructure, and particularly that's what we're trying to do. So I think we just need to keep advocating. We got to keep pushing policymakers, and we got to keep doing exactly what we're doing.
And we have an older population. We also have the benefit of healthcare technology and medicine that's increasing the continuum of life. Which is a good thing for many people, but it also amplifies the challenge.
Some of our newer developments, we're trying to create rooms where we can actually have telehealth services delivered on site, where we can connect the residents with a medical professional that may be hundreds of miles away, because we know they are going to age and they're going to live a long time, but they're also going to need contact with their medical providers. And so we're trying to technologically make it so that people can age with dignity in the housing that we create for them and connect them to the health services.
Great. And for people listening that are interested in information or for either their own personal needs or family, they can go to avestahousing.org, right?
Yes.
And then also you're active on Facebook, facebook.com/avestahousing. And because you're a modern day entity, you have a Twitter, which is @avestahousing. And so people that are interested in either what's available to them or if they have a family member that wants to investigate, what are the options? I'm sure there's resource material there.
There certainly is. We try to help as many as we can, and we also try to involve as many people in this important cause as we can.
Well, thank you so much for both the work that you're doing and all of your colleagues at Avesta. I think that we as a society, no matter how bad our politics get and our disagreements get, Americans have always had an ability to prioritize for people in need and for the human condition. And certainly housing is one of the core elements. And I think here in Maine, we should continue our focus. And thank you for all the work that you're doing for being here today.
Thank you very much. Food and shelter are pretty
critical,
basic human needs. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Well, look forward to talking to you again sometime soon. Dana Tompman, President and CEO of Avesta Housing. Please go to their website, avestahousing.org, for more information. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. We'll be back next week. Thank you.